Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK News for Thursday, February 12th. I'm Olivia Rose. The Alaska Board of Game has approved a change affecting where archers can hunt on Petersburg's Mitkoff Island. The change opens archery hunting in an area that has been closed to big game hunting, except wolves, since 1962. It eliminates a closed area south of town around the Petersburg Road system, which served as a quarter-mile corridor for decades, and adds it to a larger management area. The board voted 4-3 for the change at a meeting in Wrangell late last month. Board member Jake Garner of Anchorage voted against it.
I'm in favor of the quarter-mile corridor, kind of to the point that I looked at it the reverse with the Petersburg management area. You have that open management area that the archers can go and then participate in the hunt there after a quarter mile off of the road. So not looking to change something that's been in place and working for quite a while.
The area restricted hunters from taking big game, except for wolves, within a quarter mile from each side of Mitkoff Highway. The area runs from Petersburg's municipal limits to the Crystal Lake Hatchery about 17 miles from town. Now, this stretch of land is part of the Petersburg Management Area, which covers the town proper and is open to hunting game by bow and arrow. It creates an archery-only area for deer, moose, and black and brown bear, and it restricts the harvest of wolves to archery only. Hunting wolves by firearm used to be allowed in that area outside of town, but becoming part of the Petersburg management area means hunters can only take big game by bow and arrow. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game had a neutral stance on the change. The area includes a couple of popular recreational sites, so there were some concerns about potential conflicts between hunting and recreational user groups. Even so, board member Alan Burrett of Fairbanks voted in favor of the change.
The concerns that were raised are the same issues that potentially could have happened in the Petersburg management area. We haven't seen that. You would spread out some of the archery effort from the Petersburg management area out to the road system, and you're going to provide this additional opportunity for people that want to participate in archery.
There is still a buffer in the Petersburg management area regulation that prohibits hunting within 100 yards of roads or dwellings. And hunting will still remain closed on federal lands in the area. The Alaska Department of Transportation has faced intense scrutiny in recent months over its plan to build a new ferry terminal between Juneau and Haines. Now, the agency is drawing fire from a panel of lawmakers charged with overseeing it. Members of the House Transportation Committee accused the agency this week of pursuing a project that stands to benefit private interests, but not ferry users themselves. The Alaska Desk's Avery Elfelt reports.
Members of the House Transportation Committee slammed DOT officials on Tuesday during a fiery hearing focused on the Cascade Point Ferry Terminal project. The state, over the summer, signed a $28.5 million contract to kickstart the effort. It would entail building a ferry terminal roughly 30 miles farther north of Juneau than the current one in Auk Bay. The move ignited a wave of local opposition, including during a public comment period. Here's Rep. Louise Stutz of Kodiak during the hearing.
And you're talking about how important this is and what you think. Public comment, 622 comments came in. 92% of the people said, we don't want Cascade Point.
The pushback has largely centered around concerns that the new terminal would make regional travel less convenient and efficient as opposed to more, like the state has argued. People have also argued the funds would be better spent on improving existing ferry service. Christopher Goins is DOT's South Coast Region Director. During the hearing, he acknowledged that the numbers Stutz cited are correct and that the project has sparked a lot of, quote, fear in the public. But Goins added that the agency is taking public feedback seriously. That includes by extending the original comment period and planning two additional rounds of public meetings in Haines, Skagway, and Juneau.
My staff is going to sit there, and we are going to listen to what people have to say, because we want them to be able to put that on the record that is fair and that is just. And I think this project, of all the projects, needs that process.
Goins acknowledged public concern over the state's decision to move forward with the initial contract before soliciting public feedback. Still, he says, the agency plans to go through the proper engineering, permitting, and consultation process. That answer didn't seem to satisfy lawmakers, Stutes among them.
You're talking about having all this public outreach, and we've got, what, $30 million invested?
Committee co-chair Ashley Carrick of Fairbanks echoed that point.
When you talk about there being controversy and welcoming the dialogue, it doesn't seem to jive with the fact that dollars are already dedicated towards this project.
Lawmakers also grilled Goins and DOT Commissioner Ryan Anderson over their concerns that the project stands to benefit private interests, but not the public. For starters, the new terminal is expected to benefit a Canadian mining company's proposed gold project, which would likely use Cascade Point as its logistical base. But the terminal would also serve as a boon to Goldbelt Native Corporation, which owns the land. Here's Carrick again.
Feels very strongly to me like what's really happening is Goldbelt is the primary beneficiary of a project that the state is going to utilize federal dollars to support.
Anderson, the DOT commissioner, emphasized the importance of the private sector to the state's economy and said working with industry can help promote economic development in Alaska.
And, you know, the welfare of Alaska, the extraction of resources, those are all what the statutes say, you know, DOT should be doing.
Other lawmakers pressed agency officials over a controversial economic analysis of the project, the new terminal's overall cost, and whether it would actually generate significant savings for the state. Reporting in Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
With the Friday, February 13th deadline for public comment looming, hundreds of Alaskans are rushing to weigh in on the U.S. Interior Department's review of federal subsistence management. A Safari Club International petition is at the center of the debate. The National Sport Hunting and Fishing Group calls for changes which rural subsistence users say threaten their legal right to hunt, fish, and provide for their families. As of Monday, an Interior Department spokesman said it has received more than 430 comments, with more expected before tomorrow. When the Interior Department gave notice of its review on December 15th, Native organizations, including the Alaska Federation of Natives, were quick to sound the alarm. The announcement sparked frustrations over the limited time allowed for comment, only 60 days. Despite this, Native groups have launched statewide social media campaigns that have included webinars, massive email blasts, and educational videos. Joe Nelson, co-chair of AFN, says he's not surprised at how quickly they've mobilized.
This is a big deal, you know. It's core to our identity as a people, our way of life.
Nelson says the Safari Club proposals threaten to weaken the Alaska Native voice in subsistence management and puts future generations at risk.
We've been stewarding the place for thousands and thousands of years. It's really unconscionable, the thought of any of our grandkids not being able to hunt and fish and utilize the area that their grandparents grew up in.
Nelson hopes the Interior Department will extend its review period to allow more time for public comment, but says those who depend upon subsistence shouldn't count on that. Safari Club supporters say the proposals aren't anti-subsistence or anti-rural priority, but focused on protecting wildlife and reining in what it calls federal overreach. The sport hunting and fishing group's main push is to do away with 5 public seats on the Federal Subsistence Board and return to its original structure, made up of 5 federal agency heads who would be required to defer to state wildlife managers. It also wants rural advisory council members to be elected rather than appointed. Opponents say the proposals would take away the voice of those who live closest to the resources and depend upon them for survival. The Interior Department says its review is in the fact-finding stage. No changes will occur unless the secretaries for the Interior and Agriculture Departments, after weighing public input, decide to set a rulemaking process in motion. Written comments sent through the U.S. mail must be postmarked by February 13th. To submit comments online electronically, the deadline is at noon tomorrow. Comments can also be emailed to subsistence@ios.doi.gov. As Alaska lawmakers reckon with a tight state budget and rising costs in the Department of Corrections, lawmakers are floating an uncomfortable idea, once again sending Alaska inmates out of state. As Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, nobody seems to love the idea, but some lawmakers say it might be necessary.
Over the last 10 years, lawmakers have boosted the Department of Corrections budget by 70%. And even that hasn't been enough. The department's commissioner, Jen Winkleman, says she looks every day for ways to rearrange operations to avoid budget shortfalls. Winkleman says health care for inmates and overtime to make up for short staffing are the two largest cost drivers.
I would say it is consistently, I'll call it a perfect storm, whether that's staffing levels or vacancy rates, cuts.
Lawmakers went as far as to close one housing unit at the Spring Creek Correctional Center in Seward last year in an effort to save money. And sometimes, Winkleman says, big expenses come up unexpectedly. Here she is speaking to a House Budget Committee on Tuesday.
Approximately 2 weeks ago, we had a large fight on the yard. 48 inmates involved in a fight. Quick napkin math, we believe it to be just under $200,000 that cost us.
A spokesperson says five people were injured in the fight and all are recovering. But Winkleman says the cost-cutting move to close part of the prison may have played a role and ultimately resulted in a large unexpected cost.
Those are just those anecdotal examples of the population and the complexity. When we start overpopulating one area, what happens as a result due to the population we serve?
All of that has some senators floating a return to a practice Alaska abandoned more than a decade ago, sending prisoners out of state to save money. Wasilla State Senator Rob Yonte, Republican in the minority, filed a bill last year that would direct the Department of Corrections to explore the idea to see if it actually would save money. Here he is speaking during a hearing on Tuesday.
You know, oftentimes we get to run legislation that we're excited about, and there is none of that here.
Alaska has tried this before. In the 1990s and 2000s, the state contracted with private prisons in Colorado and Arizona. By 2005, about a third of Alaska's prisoners were held out of state in private facilities, according to news reports at the time. One of those prisoners was Adam Barger, who spent more than a decade in out-of-state prisons after his conviction in Alaska. He returned in 2013 after the state opened the $240 million Goose Creek Correctional Center in the Mat-Su Borough in an effort to bring Alaska's prisoners home. When he was transferred back, Barger says guards told him how much harder it was to manage prisoners who had been outside compared with those who had not.
We were more violent, had gang affiliations, drug addictions, behavioral problems, and were more resistant to authority than those who had never been sent out of state. Then we were released back into the community.
He asked lawmakers to oppose Yunt's bill during public testimony. The bill would mandate that Alaska prisoners be kept separate from others. It would also limit the prisoners that could be sent out of state to those with at least 7 years left on their sentence and direct prisoners be brought back to Alaska as their release date approaches. An advocate with the Alaska chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union said that sending prisoners out of state would cut them off from family and friends in Alaska and make them more likely to reoffend. Democratic Juneau Senator Jesse Keel, a member of the powerful Finance Committee, says he understands the cost concerns, but he's skeptical.
We've done that in the past. The cleanup has been both expensive and ugly, and I don't know that that's a long-term cost we want to bear.
Winkleman says that to realize any savings, the department would likely need to close a facility, and that brings with it a whole host of thorny questions about jobs, local economies, and public safety. But other top Senate budgeters say that with few options to control rising costs, it may be a choice they're forced to make. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
Landline phone service in Thorne Bay has mostly returned, according to numerous sources in the city. The Prince of Wales Island community of about 500 has experienced landline disruptions since late last year. Alaska Communications, Thorne Bay's landline provider, attributed the disruptions to hardware issues. The break in communication made it difficult to contact Thorne Bay's City Hall and Volunteer EMS Group, among others. According to emails from Alaska Communications, technicians resolved the issue last Friday. Thorne Bay's City Hall, Post Office, and Grocery Store confirmed to KRBD that their landline phones are now working. The Southeast Island School District's main office in Thorne Bay also confirmed that their landlines are working, although the school district's administrative assistant said via email that occasional static makes it difficult to hear callers. The city's school, which is adjacent to the district's main office, is still experiencing disruptions with its landline service. Alaska Communications could not immediately be reached for comment. The disruptions most notably impacted the city's volunteer EMS group, whose landline emergency dispatch number broadcasts all calls via radio to first responders on duty. The group adopted a new, temporary emergency phone line, which rang a cell phone carried by one of two dispatchers. A volunteer dispatcher with the city's EMS group said they'll use the cell phone until next week. For KFSK, I'm Olivia Rose.